I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Attorney General William Barr faced some tough questioning yesterday from Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Mazie Hirono called him a liar, saying you put the power and authority of the Office of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice behind a public relations effort to help Donald Trump protect himself. Republicans were much friendlier to Barr and blamed partisans in the DOJ of trying to take down the president. Here's Senator Josh Hawley.
My view, you want to know what's really going on here. You want to know why the counterintelligence investigation really happened. You want to know why we're all really sitting here today. That's why, right there, is because an unelected bureaucrat, an unelected official in this government, who clearly has open disdain, if not outright hatred, for Trump voters, like the people of my state, for instance, I could smell the Trump support, then tried to overturn the results of a Democratic election.
Attorney General Barr had some explaining to do after the release of a letter this week that special counsel Robert Mueller sent to Barr complaining that Barr had misled the public about the findings in Mueller's report when Barr released his summary on March 24th. Mueller wrote, "It did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of his office's work and conclusions." President Trump had used Barr's summary to proclaim that he was totally exonerated, something Mueller's report did not say. We begin this hour with Mark Mazzetti. He is Washington investigative correspondent for The New York Times, one of the reporters that broke the story about Mueller's letter to Barr. Mark, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Is there any significance that Mueller's letter was released and published in your paper, some other papers as well, a day before Barr's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee?
Well, this was a story that we had been working on for some time, and I'd say several days. And just in terms of the timing, we went to the Justice Department for comment on Tuesday afternoon, and because we knew we were going to publish the story. And then they put out a statement on Tuesday night acknowledging the letter. So that was the sort of how the timing of this came together, and we first learned about the existence of the letter, which then was made public in full yesterday morning.
How out of character was this letter coming from Mueller?
You know, it's not necessarily out of character in terms of, you know, this is how, you know, lawyers and prosecutors communicate. They write in letters. However, it is at the same time, I would say, a very extraordinary step for him to do it because it shows the extent of the concern, anger, frustration, whatever word you want to use, within his team about how Barr's letter characterized the findings. So it's not something they do lightly because, you know, as everyone knows in these organizations, especially lawyers, if you write a letter, then it needs to be acknowledged. It's a record. So for them to put it in writing, say, hey, you did not capture the essence of, not only the essence, but the context, the full, you know, content of our findings, it's a big deal.
Well, in fact, Mueller really is saying you misrepresented our conclusions.
Yeah, that's right. It's not that, you know, the letter doesn't say, you know, we reported X and you said it was Y, a complete distortion. But what he's saying certainly is that in producing this bare bones letter that distilled things in a misleading way, the public did not understand what exactly Mueller had found, especially on this issue of obstruction of justice, which, you know, Mueller's team had spent, you know, 200 pages laying out the evidence and their conclusions are, you know, very, you know, distilled in a way that Mueller's team found misleading.
You write, your most recent article is a more sort of detailed explanation of this letter and the decision that Barr made on March 24th to release his executive summary. March 22nd, the Mueller report is delivered to DOJ and to Barr. They spend the weekend going over it, then Sunday afternoon release his executive summary. What happened in those couple of days there over that weekend?
Yeah, it was really interesting. Yesterday, a lot of new detail came out about kind of this intense period of 4 or 5 days that we now know there was a lot more dispute within the Justice Department than we knew before. So Mueller delivers his report Friday the 22nd. Barr puts his letter out the 24th, that Sunday afternoon, but we learned that, you know, hours before, there was communication with the Mueller team, where the Mueller team was saying, hey, as a reminder, we made summaries. We made these executive summaries. You know, we don't know exactly how much they pushed Barr to put those out on that day, but certainly there was a reminder that, hey, you know, we kind of did the work for you. You don't need to distill our work. And then once the Barr letter came out Sunday afternoon, President Trump declares full, complete exoneration. By the next morning, there was a letter from Mueller's team to Barr basically saying, hey, you mischaracterized this. And then there's another letter that comes 2 days later. And then after that, Barr picks up the phone and calls Mueller and he says, why are you writing all these letters? Stop writing the letters. And, you know, there is a clear sign that Barr, you know, will not try, doesn't want to put up with something yesterday he kind of characterizes in a way as sort of insubordination. He said, you know, Robert Mueller is effectively a U.S. attorney. He works for me. And, you know, he shouldn't be doing this.
Well, it's interesting. Now, the word of the week is snitty, which is what Attorney General Barr called Mueller's letter to him. And essentially saying it looked like the work of some kind of underling. You say in your in your most recent report that these two gentlemen were, I don't know if they still are, but were friends, right?
Yeah, and a lot was made of that during the confirmation hearing of Barr, how, you know, he respects Mueller, he and Mueller are friends, their wives are friends, this is someone who, you know, is part of the, you know, Washington legal establishment. What has been striking to me in the last month, and it really came through yesterday, was there is real, I don't want, you know, whether you call it animosity or there's real tension, there's a real rift between the two men. And Barr is clearly angry at a few things. He thinks that Mueller, you know, shouldn't have been writing those letters. He thinks that there seems to be some degree of tension over the fact that Mueller, in his view, you know, didn't complete his job by not making a definitive judgment on obstruction of justice. Barr felt, well, he left it for me to do it. Now, one could say that he actually didn't really leave it for Barr to do it. Maybe he was sort of saying, well, Congress should weigh in. There's a real rift between these two sides that I think was very apparent in the hours of testimony yesterday.
It was interesting because he said on the one hand, Mueller works. Is he still at the Justice Department, by the way? Is Mueller still there? Is he still employed?
Yes, he is for the time being. So he is still a Justice Department employee. And, you know, Barr made that clear yesterday. You know, he likened him to, well, he's like a U.S. attorney.
Right.
He produces a report to me. And as Barr said yesterday, once he did, this was my baby. And this was my decision. And effectively, you know, Bob Mueller should know his place.
Interestingly, though, under questioning, I think it was from Senator Kamala Harris, Attorney General Barr admitted that he basically took Mueller's report at its face value. He didn't vet all the information or the conclusions that Mueller and his team came to. Does he end up putting himself into some hot water there, do you think?
You know, we'll see. I mean, it came out like, you know, how much did he actually read it and, you know, digest everything in the report? I mean, I think, you know, he and his team certainly understood the weight of the conclusions of the Mueller report, you know, but it does really raise questions about why they felt the need to so quickly put out this summary letter. You know, again, it was 48 hours after Mueller delivered his report, and why they did it in the way they did it with such a sort of terse set of summary findings that really did set the narrative in place over those 3 weeks until the full Mueller report came out.
Mueller, even in his letter, talks about there is now public confusion about critical aspects of the results of our investigation. This threatens to undermine a central purpose for which the department appointed the special counsel, to assure full public confidence in the outcome of the investigations. It is a short letter, and it is certainly worth reading. But it seems that Barr is blaming the media for these misconceptions.
Well, yeah, and he's making a big deal that that it was the Mueller who also was concerned about the media. You know, everyone should read this letter from Mueller because, it says very, it's lawyerly and careful. But as we said, the existence of the letter is more important than the language in a way, right? But he is he's clearly saying that it was Barr's letter that distorted things. There's no mention in that letter about media coverage.
Right.
But Barr says, well, Mueller was really worried about how the media was portraying it. Now, we don't know that. We're taking Barr's word that this is what Mueller conveyed in their phone call. So, I it's unclear still, what the real concern is from Mueller, other than what we know he put in his letter. And I think this is why, at some point, we are going to hear Bob Mueller testify, as Barr did yesterday. And when that is, we're not sure.
Yeah. I don't know if you can answer this, Mark, but the thing that I kept thinking about was that Barr knew what was in the Mueller report. He knew that what he said did not line up exactly with what the Mueller report said. So at some point, whether it's the history books or just even reporting, is going to show that there was and is a pretty big difference between how these two members of the Justice Department approach this issue and the conclusions that they came to.
Yeah, Barr, it clearly seems angry, I'd say, about how this is being portrayed. Did not think that this 4-page letter would, cause the controversy that it did. I mean, thinks that he seemed a little blindsided by this. Uh-huh. He said yesterday this was the whole thing was, he said, I think, mind-bendingly bizarre because, he committed to put the report out and it only took 3 weeks and it eventually did come out. And so he thinks this is, and he's made this as sort of something that's a tempest in a teapot. At the same time, this was this long and awaited investigation. Mueller delivers his report, and the first accounting of Mueller's findings came in Barr's letter. And I think for a lot of Americans, that was it. The Barr summary of his findings was, the end, and then they moved on. And as we now know, the Barr's summary of the findings was not the end because it was really quite different once you read the Mueller report, especially on this issue of obstruction of justice.
Mark, we have to leave it there, and I thank you very much for joining us once again on Radio Times. And again, that's Mark Mazzetti. He is Washington investigative correspondent for The New York Times. We're going to take a very short break, and we've got Senator Coons of Delaware waiting in the wings. We will talk more about yesterday's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I should add that Senator Coons sits on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we'll be talking after this short break. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're discussing Attorney General William Barr's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday about his handling of the special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into the 2016 presidential campaign. Mueller had written to Barr complaining that Barr was misrepresenting what was in the Mueller report. Barr was dismissive of Mueller's letter.
I don't consider Bob at this stage a career prosecutor. He's had a career as a prosecutor.
Well, he's a very eminent prosecutor.
He was the head of the FBI for 12 years.
He's a career.
He's had a
law enforcement career,
yeah.
Professional.
Right.
Yep. I know of no other instance of.
But he was also a political appointee, and he was a political appointee with me at the Department of Justice. The letter's a bit snitty, and I think it was probably written by one of his staff people.
Joining us now is Delaware Senator Chris Coons. He sits on the Judiciary Committee, asks some pointed questions, and is once again back on Radio Times. Senator Coons, nice to have you with us.
Good morning, Marty. Good to be with you again.
Nice to have you with us again. And let me just give out the phone number and ways that our listeners can join our conversation. That's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Senator, you tweeted yesterday, it's now clear to me that Attorney General Barr believes he's the president's defense lawyer, not the American people's lawyer. That is not the way this is supposed to work. Is it time for Barr to go?
Well, frankly, he's not going to. So I hope that we can find a way to focus on ways that we can actually address and solve the real problems facing the American people. This particular episode with President Trump's attorney general is another disheartening, I think, step in the steady politicization of the American law enforcement and judicial system. So I don't expect Attorney General Barr to resign or to be removed. He enjoys the support of a majority in the Senate. And so, you know, frankly, I think we need to focus on what we can affect or make a change in.
Well, let me ask you about some of the questions that you asked yesterday, and you framed several of them, which I thought was interesting and I think helpful in a way, which is what is illegal and what is unacceptable? How do you see those two things?
Well, Barr kept sort of pushing the issue into whether they could or could not charge certain offenses as a crime or certain actions. And I think Senator Hirono had a particularly pointed series of questions about this because he was refusing to comment in any way on what is or isn't acceptable conduct. So one of the things I was trying to get more clarity about was when a candidate is contacted by a hostile power saying, you know, we've got derogatory information, we've got dirt on your opponent, is it acceptable, is it legal to simply say, great, I love it, let's have a meeting, give me information? And he wasn't particularly clear or forthcoming in answering that question. When I asked it, several other senators asked similar questions. Is it appropriate for the White House counsel to lie? Is it appropriate for senior staff of the president to help fabricate untruthful answers to either press accounts or to generate fake documents? Marty, the reason I'm asking these things, the reason several of us ask these things, is that Volume 2 of the Mueller report makes it abundantly clear that there was a whole series of instances, at least 10 different instances, where there was evidence of obstruction of justice. There was evidence of public misrepresentation by the president or his core team, instances where he directed his White House counsel to try and fire the special counsel or to generate false documents or to generate false press accounts. And all of this has to at least be clearly called out as unacceptable behavior by the president and his senior team. What I objected to in the way that Attorney General Barr handled the release of the Mueller report was that his letter to us in the Congress, which only focused on the principal conclusions of the report, created a longer than three-week window for the president to sort of jump up and down and celebrate his complete exoneration, as he characterized it, when in fact the Mueller report details hundreds of pages worth of instances of unacceptable conduct. Whether or not it was criminal conduct is something obviously we're still disagreeing about, but it was clearly unacceptable conduct. And I think it's important for the American people, you know, look, the vast majority of whom will not take the time to read the Mueller report.
400 pages.
People, they have busy lives. But it's important that we characterize what is revealed in the Mueller report as clearly unacceptable and inappropriate behavior by the president and members of his senior team, and frankly, admirable conduct by several of his core folks who refused to follow unethical or illegal orders.
I have a couple of questions before we have to go, and I want to squeeze in another clip from yesterday's testimony, but just a quick follow-up to that. I mean, obviously, Mueller and Barr were looking for evidence of a crime, but if a president cannot be charged with a crime, what was the point of the investigation?
What an excellent question. That's why I want Bob Mueller. I think Robert Mueller should testify in front of our committee to help clarify for the American public what's the framework. Implicit in one of Barr's answers was that if Mueller had found clear and convincing evidence of criminal activity that rose to some certain level, he would have challenged the OLC memo that prevents
Office of Legal Counsel. Yeah.
Excuse me. There is an Office of Legal Counsel memo from from decades ago, I think, at this point, that says you cannot indict a sitting president. So there was a very high bar of proof of criminal conduct by the president. I'm concerned that one of the consequences of this episode is that the president is literally going to be above the law. In the attorney general and in our two most recently seated Supreme Court justices, we have individuals who are committed to a theory of executive power, of a unitary executive, that makes it harder and harder for the president to even be investigated, let alone held responsible for illegal conduct while president. That, to me, is a very troubling development and well worth our debating in the Congress.
Let me play another clip from yesterday's Senate Judiciary hearing. And this is Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. He is questioning Attorney General Barr about his use of the word spying.
Have you ever referred to authorized department investigative activities officially or publicly as spying? I'm not asking for private conversation.
Yeah, I'm not going to abjure the use of the word spying. I think, you know, my first job was in CIA, and I don't think the word spying has any pejorative connotation at all.
To me, the question
is always whether or not it's authorized and adequately predicated spying. I think spying is a good English word that, in fact, doesn't have synonyms because it is the broadest word incorporating really all forms of covert intelligence collections.
You know, we could have a linguistic discussion about the word spying, but at the same time, this is coming from the Attorney General. Spying is the word that the president has used to describe surveillance. What did you make of that, Senator? Then I know we have to say goodbye to you.
I thought the idea that the Attorney General said spying doesn't have pejorative connotations was literally laughable. When you say that you're being spied upon or that, you know, the previous administration inappropriately or illegally spied on your campaign, it obviously has pejorative connotations. You don't have to use the words illegally or inappropriately. Spying carries with it a clear negative connotation. And, you know, the Attorney General might cite his early service in the CIA to say, oh, no, spying is actually a good thing, a neutral thing, a positive thing. I don't think that was the way he used it. I don't think that's the way he meant it. I don't think that that's the way it's being heard. And it leapt out at me when in his previous testimony before the Judiciary Committee, he used that word, because I think it is meant to reinforce the president's sense of grievance, his sense of so far unsubstantiated allegations that he was on the receiving end of inappropriate activity by the previous administration.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Senator Coons, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And that's Delaware Senator Chris Coons, and he does sit on the Judiciary Committee and was one of the questioners yesterday questioning Attorney General Barr. Barr did refuse to appear before the House Judiciary Committee today, complaining that he would be questioned by a committee lawyer as well as lawmakers. Chairman Jerry Nadler said he would give Barr a few days to think it over before seeking a contempt citation. Well, joining us now and here in our Philadelphia studios is Max Kennerly. He's a trial lawyer here in Philadelphia at Kennerly and Lowdy. Max, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
And joining us by telephone is Sam Stein, politics editor at The Daily Beast and an MSNBC contributor. Sam Stein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Sam, what was your main takeaway from yesterday's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee?
Well, I guess I still am surprised by the degree to which the administration just simply and outrightly doesn't care for congressional oversight. The most obvious element of it was actually not in the hearing itself, but what came afterwards, which was Attorney General Barr deciding that he simply wouldn't show up for this morning session with the House Judiciary members. And there's a sort of not an anger, but just a snideness, I think, that the White House now exhibits for the idea that Congress should have any input or insight into its operations, which is placing us in as close to a constitutional crisis as we've been. If Congress cannot have access to witnesses, if they can't have access to government documents from the executive branch, if the administration is simply going to defy and ignore subpoenas, there is a real potential massive conflict on the horizon over this stuff. And so, you know, I'm not surprised that Barr came to the defense of the administration. We knew from his conduct leading up to yesterday that he viewed the Mueller findings in a particular light. We knew that he felt there was nothing worth prosecuting from the data that Mueller collected. But what surprised me is the degree to which he's simply going to ignore what are legitimate concerns about the presidential conduct and also ignore congressional oversight inquiries into the administration going forward.
Max, your main takeaway?
I think it was interesting how little Attorney General Barr defended any of the merits of Trump's conduct. And, you know, of course, the fact that he didn't show up today for his House Judiciary hearing adds to that. But even on the few occasions where he tried to get into the substance of it, he either claimed he wasn't aware of the details or he couldn't provide any sorts of details. You know, for example, Senator Coons was talking about the spying comment. Right. The Republican questioners tried to elicit from Attorney General Barr, you know, they tossed him a softball question about, well, tell us some more about spying so we get a nice little clip for the news. And he had to demur there too and had to say that, you know, well, we're looking into it. And in the further questioning, you know, Attorney General Barr is putting all of these negative implications into the public about the Mueller investigation. He's questioned about how the counterintelligence investigation ran, which is described in the Mueller report of George Papadopoulos talks to an Australian.
That's how it all got started.
And Attorney General Barr indicated that he was completely unfamiliar with this. And it's kind of amazing that, you know, you're throwing out these sorts of accusations about Mueller. You're not even familiar with the details. And when he got to questioning about Trump's conduct, even then still, he wanted to avoid talking about the facts of what had actually occurred. He wanted to avoid talking about Mueller's factual findings and instead, you know, dodge around with where he was going to answer. And, you know, it kind of goes into this bigger run-out-the-clock strategy that you see from a lot of the Trump administration, both in terms of delaying compliance with oversight, the lawsuits filed against, you know, Deutsche Bank to stop Democratic subpoenas. And it seems that they're approaching this not as government officers, both Trump and Attorney General Barr. They're approaching this the way that like a corporate defendant would, of just litigate everything for as long as possible.
Well, let me pick up on that and toss this to you, Sam. And as we know, Chairman Nadler is giving Barr a couple of days to think over whether he's going to appear before the House Judiciary Committee. But do you think there is a patience potential problem? And by that, I mean, if you're going to have hearings that go on for months and months on end, is the public either going to lose interest or lose track of what it is that this whole thing is all about?
I think the real problem Nadler may confront here is not that the public loses interest. I think, you know, we're news junkies. We follow this stuff religiously, and we will inherently be obsessed with every twist and turn. I think that's not true for the vast majority of the public. So I don't think that's the issue Nadler runs into. I think one of the issues that Nadler runs into is that his Democratic colleagues and the activists lose patience with him. You know, pretty much we can predict how this is going to play out. In fact, people have been predicting how it's going to play out. And I understand why Nadler wants to take the high ground and seem as if he's accommodating. But at a certain point, you either need to just get going or don't go at all. Right. And I've already seen reaction among, you know, highly respected Democratic operatives who say, why are you giving Barr another 2 days or potentially three or four? He's not going to show up. And if this is about protecting the institutional prerogatives of a co-equal branch of government, then what you need to do is you need to act like a co-equal branch of government. And so there is already a sense of brewing frustration that I'm picking up from my own reporting. And maybe that's impatience. And Nadler's going to test that proposition. But I don't, again, I don't think the public is the problem. I think it's whether he loses the faith of his fellow Democrats.
Let me play another clip. And this is Attorney General William Barr, again, at yesterday's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, basically saying the president does not need to let an investigation run its course if he believes it is based on false accusations.
If, in fact, a proceeding was not well-founded, if it was a groundless proceeding, if it was based on false allegations, the president does not have to sit there constitutionally and allow it to run its course.
What do you make of that, Max Kennerly, as our resident lawyer here?
I think there's two ways to look at this. One of them is the purely legal sense. The attorney general implying that you can't prosecute a criminal defendant if they say they had good motives is just absurd. That's not how criminal law works.
Even if that person is the president of the United States.
Well, that's the second one of when we get into structurally, constitutionally. But the fact that, you know, Barr, both at his hearing yesterday and in his prior press conference, he kept going into these arguments about Trump's intent. You know, at his press conference, he said, well, Trump was genuinely frustrated. At the hearing yesterday, he said, well, Trump truly believed that it was inaccurate. And the truth is, that's not going to work with any prosecutor in America. If we're talking about, if we had a legal case here, putting aside the president, nobody ever gets out of criminal prosecution by saying, I thought I was doing the right thing.
Right.
So this starts as a bit of an absurd argument of, well, we could find proper intent by Trump. I mean, that just doesn't work in any courthouse in America. The second one is the constitutional side. And it's like Senator Coons was referencing, the unitary executive. There's been this theory pushed over the past, you know, two or three decades of the idea that the president is completely above the law and whatever the president does is inherently constitutional because he's the president.
Right. Now, it's a policy, we should say.
Yes. And that's the thing is the president then doing something makes it a policy. Now, there's not really a constitutional foundation for this. It's not found in the text of the Constitution. You know, for example, Congress has the ability to be exempt from criminal prosecutions for what they say on the House floor and the Senate floor, but the president does not. The framers addressed this at the time.
We'll hold on to that thought, and we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with Max Kennerly and Sam Stein. We are deconstructing yesterday's testimony by Attorney General Barr before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about Attorney General William Barr's questions and answers before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday about his handling of the Mueller report. He was a no-show for the House Judiciary Committee meeting today. And again, our guests are Sam Stein, he's politics editor at the Daily Beast, also an MSNBC contributor, joining us by telephone. Max Kennerly here with us in our Philadelphia studios. He's a trial lawyer here in the city at Kennerly Lowdy. And you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Max, it's always important to talk about the Constitution, so let me give you a chance just to finish that briefly, and then we'll put up some more clips as well.
So one of the points I was making there is this idea that the president can't be prosecuted and the related idea that the president is free from oversight from Congress, this unitary executive idea.
Right.
You really can't find this in the Constitution's text or in its structure or in its original debates. And, you know, for example, the speech and debate clause, which gives members of Congress complete immunity for everything that they say or do on the floor of their houses, that actually previously has been interpreted to immunize them even from courts questioning what they do in their proceedings. You know, the case law on these congressional subpoenas reaches the speech and debate clause as to whether a court could ever stop Congress from issuing a subpoena. So all the way up until a few decades ago, this was understood that there's an immunity for Congress, but the framers didn't create any sort of immunity for the president there whatsoever. They didn't say he's immune from his conduct in office from prosecution. They certainly didn't say he was immune from oversight from Congress. In fact, they structured it so Congress, if they wanted to, could completely defund him. They could impeach him for virtually any reason. And that's what we're seeing here is a challenge to that, of trying to invert it, that the president is above the law entirely and above Congress as well.
Well, Sam, let me give you a chance to respond. Are those constitutional legal issues playing out in Washington as we speak?
Well, playing out is sort of a broad term, right? They're definitely obviously being discussed. And certainly there are organizations that are trying to figure out what the legal remedies are for acts like Barr is talking about. But to a large degree, there's a sense of helplessness that I'm picking up when I talk to Democrats today, that the remedies that they are trying to pursue simply won't materialize in anything. And so, yes, it's playing out, but far more often than not, what you see, especially from Democratic leadership, is that they feel like the right remedies are political ones, that an election is coming up and that 2020 could theoretically wipe the slate clean and you won't actually have to deal with these messy legal questions. And so, again, the tension is breaking up within the party, which is what kind of precedent do you set if you don't actually question or challenge the constitutionality and you just strictly look at it through an electoral lens? And that's why what you've seen this week is so important, which is in refusing to have testimony today, in refusing to offer documents up for even under threat of subpoena, the administration may be defying Congress, but they're also pushing some lawmakers, including more establishment types, towards the camp that impeachment may have to be a consideration. I don't know if this plays out to the point where Nancy Pelosi says or gives it the green light, but that is the cause-reaction that we're seeing right now in Washington, D.C.
Well, let me play another clip. This is Senator Kamala Harris questioning Attorney General Barr about whether if he or Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein or anyone from his staff had reviewed the evidence in the Mueller report, and this is from yesterday's committee hearing.
Did you personally review all of the underlying evidence?
No, we took and accepted.
Mr. Rosenstein?
No, we accepted the statements in the report as the factual record. We did not go underneath it to see whether or not they were accurate. We accepted it as accurate and made our.
So you accepted the report as the evidence?
Yes.
You did not question or look at the underlying evidence that supports the conclusions in the report?
No.
Did Mr. Rosenstein review the evidence that underlines and supports the conclusions in the report, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge. We accepted the statements in the report.
Did
and
anyone
the characterization
in your,
of the evidence is true.
Did anyone in your executive office review the evidence supporting the report?
No.
No.
And that's Senator Kamala Harris, one of three senators currently running for president of the United States, clearly a seasoned prosecutor. Sam, any quick response to that? And I'll go to Max as well.
Yeah, no, this was a profound moment, and it was interesting. I talked to some folks who were almost not apologetic towards Barr, but understood where he was coming from. And then I talked to folks who thought this was deeply disturbing. Again, keep in mind, Barr himself at one point said that Mueller had essentially punted to him the prosecution decision, and that I think his quote was, "This was my baby." So he knew the weight of the decision he had to make because it was given to him. And yet later in the testimony, as under question from Senator Harris, he admits that he actually didn't look at the underlying evidence. He just, he took the conclusions drawn by Mueller and applied them in his own prosecutorial lens. So I thought that was a remarkable reveal, and to the degree that it did, it affirmed an immense skepticism that people have with Barr, which is that he had come to the conclusions that he wanted to come to even prior to seeing the report. And so, if there was a misstep, a political misstep that Barr made yesterday, and I think there were several, I would argue that this is one of them, which is him basically saying, no, I didn't bother to look at the data myself. I just went with the summary and made my own prosecution decision.
Max, your thoughts?
Well, one point that Sam raised there is Barr later explained this is he described this as normal. in a prosecutor's office. And if we step out of Mueller and Trump and all the rest of that, he's not wrong on that point of oftentimes, you know, right now inside of a U.S. attorney's office, there are assistant U.S. attorneys who have prepared memorandum about prosecutions, which they then provide to a U.S. attorney who then makes a decision of prosecutor decline. And the U.S. attorney is not necessarily sure. Reading all the underlying evidence. Where this goes awry is the context here of, you know, the importance of what's going on, the nature of Mueller's report itself and how far it goes into these. And second, the fact that Barr reached a completely different conclusion from Mueller and can't explain
right.
why. And that's the thing, which is that, you know, we don't have Giuliani's claimed rebuttal memo, and we don't have virtually anything from Attorney General Barr as to why he declined the prosecution. You know, we have his letter that says, "I decline." We have his brief press conference, and we have his brief statements to the committee. He's never gone into the substance of any of these as to really elaborate why he felt that the facts would not establish obstruction of justice, other than to briefly say, well, it seems the president was sincere in his beliefs.
Well, let me quote something from the report, and then we'll get some folks to join us. And this is the report having to do with obstruction of justice and the president. The report says, at the same time, if we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. And again, kind of legalistic, but they are, I think that's an important sentence. Let me read an email from Carol saying, Attorney General Barr had one heck of a nerve saying Bob Mueller was a political appointee when Barr is also a political appointee. And there is, as we were hearing from our first guest, looks like some, if not bad blood, certainly some tension between these two members of the Justice Department.
There certainly could be. You know, on one level, though, lawyers get into arguments all the time. It's just what we do.
It's kind of your nature, isn't it?
It's kind of our nature. And I've certainly sent and received snitty letters with, you know, opposing counsel, even if I have a friendly relationship with them. You know, at the same time, this idea of politics and a political conspiracy and partisan motives. Bob Mueller is a Republican. He was appointed FBI director by a Republican president, and he's here as special counsel because the Republican president, Trump, appointed the Republican Rosenstein as deputy attorney general, who appointed the Republican Mueller. So there's no partisanship here. In fact, it's a little bit absurd that this is all Republicans internally investigating themselves and then claiming a partisan conspiracy here.
Let me get Steve from New Jersey. And Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning, I'm sorry. But
that's okay.
You guys made a comment earlier in the show about if Americans were going to get tired of this investigation. And I've got to say, I'm one of them. I'm a blue-collar worker in New Jersey. And, you know, every time this investigation comes up, my eyes just kind of roll, like, here we go. You know, if they're not going to charge the president with anything, it almost seems pointless.
Well, I appreciate your call, Steve. And Sam, you mentioned the fact that among some of the leaders in the Democratic Party, probably concerned about people like Steve from New Jersey.
Yeah. I mean, there's two things happening here. One is Steve from New Jersey, although he's a blue-collar worker, is right. probably in the minority of the country still in terms of his attention to this saga. It is all-encompassing for a lot of people, but if you talk to any politician who has, you know, been campaigning on the trail, they'll tell you that Russia, the Russia investigation, and the Mueller report rarely, if ever, comes up in conversation. So I still think that, you know, the discussion is segmented a bit. But the other thing is that Steve does bring up a very valid point that you hear all the time, which is, you know, to the degree that Democrats do obsess over this and light their hair on fire over this, there is concern within the ranks that it's not politically, strategically the sound mm-hmm. thing to do, that people don't really care all that much about the fact that, you know, about the fallout of the Mueller report. They want to know what's going on with their health care bills. Whether they're going to have to continue to pay off their college loans, things like that. And so the party's trying to balance this the best they can, which is why you saw Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer this week, in the midst of all this obstruction and drama, go to the White House to talk about a $2 trillion infrastructure package. It was a remarkable dichotomy at play. But
do you think they're going to get $2 million for infrastructure, Sam?
$2 trillion.
$2 trillion.
They might get $2 million. But $2 trillion, no, I don't. But they want to appear as if they're going to get it. And what I would say is that there's concern within the ranks yet again that if you just act like everything is normal outside of the scope of the Mueller probe, and if you just conduct business as usual as the administration mounts an unprecedented campaign of obstruction of congressional oversight, you in effect normalize that conduct. And so there is a lot of pressure on Pelosi and Schumer to not just cancel these types of meetings as a payback to Trump of sorts, but to also focus more aggressively on these matters, even if it risks turning off voters, because they're worried not just about the present, they're worried about the future and what kind of precedent this type of stuff sets.
Let me play one more clip, and this is Senator Richard Blumenthal questioning Barr, asking him whether he thinks President Trump lied to the American people.
In your view, did President Trump on those occasions and others recited in the report lie to the American people?
Well, I'm not in the business of determining when lies are told to the American people. I'm in the business of determining whether a crime has been committed.
Well, there it is, Max.
Well, I think, you know, there is a body that's in the business of determining whether lies are told to American people, and that's Congress. And, you know, we are both fortunate and unfortunate of we have a recent history of impeaching a president, and we have numerous senators, including Lindsey Graham and at that time Jeff Sessions, giving impassioned speeches about how you don't need a crime to impeach the president and that it's about restoring integrity to the office and all of these sorts of larger big themes about democracy itself and how the presidency is conducted. You know, I think it's interesting if it's tiring because we've been hearing about Mueller for so long. If there wasn't the Mueller investigation, the actual story would be we had 2 years of a Republican House that did no oversight and a Republican Senate that did no oversight. And now Democrats, having just acquired their committee chairships in January, are finally able to do some sort of oversight. And I think a lot of Democrats are kind of stuck in this bind of everyone's tired of investigating the president, but on a practical level, they've only just been able to start in this January.
Well, and I'm old enough to remember Watergate and how long that lasted. Sam, let me ask you about Senator Lindsey Graham, who headed up the committee yesterday. When he was running for president, he had nothing good to say about Donald Trump.
Right. And, you know, it was ironic to see him go through these texts of FBI agents ripping then-candidate Donald Trump for being, you know, off his rocker, unelectable, a disaster, when Graham was saying things just as bad, if not worse. And so, you know, that said, I will give Graham some credit. He was not part of the FBI team investigating Donald Trump at the time, and Lisa Page and Strzok should probably not have said that, and they've been reprimanded and pushed out of the agency for it. But Lindsey Graham is a perfect template for what's happened to a lot of Republicans in the age of Trump, which is you start out finding the whole thing farcical, you move on to objecting vociferously to it and fighting it as much as you can. You then get to the point of acceptance, and then you get to the point of acquiescence. And Graham, you know, has clearly – Graham, we should note, is up for re-election this year and needs to make it through Republican primary. He clearly has decided that his future is as an ally to Donald Trump, and not just as an ally, but an extremely close ally who will be the tip of the spear for Donald Trump. So in addition to Bill Barr refusing to testify today before the House, the other remarkable thing that I – took away from yesterday was Lindsey Graham leaving that hearing after all the drama, all the confusion, all the potential risks that had developed between Barr and Mueller, and unilaterally declaring that he was done. He was just done investigating, that he was not going to call Bob Mueller to his committee, and that he was not going to call Don McGahn, even though Don McGahn is the central protagonist in questions of whether obstruction occurred. And that is just an incredible abdication of congressional oversight by one of the most important members of the Senate. And he's doing it because largely he believes that, you know, Donald Trump should get the right to move on. And it is, if nothing else, an indication that at least one party does not view Congress as a co-equal branch of government, but as a supplicant to the president.
Well, we have to end our conversation. Sam Stein, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And Max Kennerly, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. A call from Mary. Democrats need to do a better job of showing the consequences of obstruction of justice, or else people won't care. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.